Welcome to the presentation of a lecture from Gnostic Radio, a free public service from Telema Press. Gnostic Radio broadcasts free lectures from the Gnostic tradition of Samael on Vior. Gnosis is the root wisdom of all the world's great religions. Gnosis is a universal doctrine containing the precise science to free the soul from suffering. To find additional information about Gnosis, such as books, videos, and online courses, or to engage in online discussions, visit our website at GnosticTeachings.org. This lecture was made possible through the generous support of listeners like you. For more information or to make a donation, visit GnosticTeachings.org. Now, with heartfelt wishes for the end of suffering, we begin the lecture. May all beings be happy. The methodology of the Gnostic Dharma is based in practical science. To understand what gnosis is, we have to understand the meaning of the word. And the understanding comes from looking at the roots of these words, Gnostic and Dharma. Dharma is from Sanskrit and really carries with it many meanings. It can be interpreted as law or truth. The word dharma can be used to describe the way something works in its fundamental basis, an essential truth. The essential nature of the way a phenomena occurs. And this is the root that we're most interested in, is the use of the word dharma in relationship with truth, or how reality actually comes to be, is sustained, and is understood. Of course, we also use the word dharma to talk about the nature of the teachings. So you'll often hear about the dharma in reference to any teaching that is grounded in a practical application and that leads us to arrive at our own personal experience, our own direct conscious knowledge of the way reality truly is. And this is where we arrive to this word Gnostic. Gnostic comes from a Greek word. And the basis of this word is knowledge. And this is where we get the word knowledge from, gnosis. But knowledge in this case is not just intellectual knowledge or an emotional knowledge, something we might believe in. It's more the kind of knowledge that we acquire consciously through our own experience. A simple example of a form of Gnostic knowledge that all of us have is about the law of gravity. All of us have experience with the law of gravity. When we're growing up as children, we learn how to manipulate and control our physical body in relationship with the law of gravity. We don't ever really understand that intellectually until a little bit later in life. But consciously, experientially, we learn how to negotiate and work with the law of gravity when we learn how to walk, when we learn how to run, to jump, to play. And that is Gnostic in the sense that it's from our own experience that we learn how that law functions. It's not necessary for us to have learned about gravity intellectually, although later when we do so, it helps us. So when we talk about Gnostic Dharma, really we're talking about the same thing, the same function, but in relation with our own psychology, in relation with how the planet functions, how life is. All the mysteries of life and death, how life and death move and flow. So the Gnostic Dharma is a science of practical knowledge. In order for us to really understand what Dharma is and what Gnosis is, we have to practice. And that's why we talk about practical teachings, practical methods, something that we ourselves can use, not just to think about it or to theorize about it or to believe in it, but to use it, to experiment. And that experimentation is something that we have to do inside, in our own mind, in our own heart, in our own consciousness. When you look at the Dharma or the teachings from this point of view, you can understand that if a sincere person is really applying the technique, the variety of techniques in themselves, practically, really working with them, then it doesn't matter what they believe. It doesn't matter where they're from, who they are. Anyone can experiment with Gnosis, with Dharma, and arrive at conclusions because the truth is universal. Just the same way, whatever part of the planet a child is born, when they start to grow, they will universally experience the law of gravity. Every child. And every child that is born and begins to grow has to learn to work with that law, to learn to control their physical body in relationship with that law. And this is universal. But there are additional laws. There are other phenomena in nature that are also universal, that any person, anywhere, anytime, can learn how to work with consciously in order to navigate their life in a better way. So this is the point. Life is very challenging. Life is very difficult. In Buddhism, the first truth taught by the Buddha is that life is suffering. And this, on first glance, can sound very bleak, to be something that's very morbid or very depressing. But when you look deeper into that noble truth, what the Buddha taught, you can see that actually there's a great deal of beauty and hope in those noble truths. Because what he taught was, yes, life is suffering so long as we do not work on ourselves. When we learn how to actually acquire our own gnosis, our own direct experience of the laws that govern existence, then we can begin to transcend suffering. And then happiness becomes our way of being. And you can see this in any highly realized individual, that they naturally radiate happiness, peacefulness, serenity, joy. So for them, life has changed. And it's not because they changed something outside of themselves, it's because they changed themselves. They change their attitude to life. And this is the nature of any real Dharma, any real Gnosis. It leads the sincere practitioner towards true peace of mind. And this is the point. Unfortunately, because of the mind that we have, we misunderstand this. And we tend to hear about religion or about mysticism or about Dharma, and we take it in as a belief or as a theory. As an illustration of that, there's a story from Buddhism that relates the true nature of Dharma or gnosis. The story goes that the Buddha Shakyamuni arrived in a particular area of India to give his teachings, and by this time his reputation was widespread as being a great holy person, someone that maybe even has powers. So some of the local people had one of their relatives die. And of course, they were very distraught and upset about the death of their beloved. So this family came to see the Buddha. And with their hearts, with pain, came to entreat him, to beg him, to intercede on their behalf and to pray for their dead relative. And the Buddha saw, of course, their suffering and their pain and said, "Okay, I'll help you. Go and get a jar, a big jar, and put in it some rocks, and also put in it some ghee. If you don't know already, ghee is clarified butter." So they put the rocks and the ghee in the jar, and the Buddha told them, "Seal it. Put a wax seal on it. And now take it over to this pond and put it in the water, deep." So they do all of this, full of the fervent belief that this great holy person, this saint, is going to intercede for them and guide their dead relative to heaven so that his spirit, his soul, his consciousness would ascend to the heavenly realms and not have to descend into the unpleasant worlds or hell. So they follow his instructions. They put the vase in the pond. And then he says, "Now one of you take a stick and with the stick shatter the vase, the jar that's in the water." So they do this. And after a moment, a few bubbles come to the surface. And then a little bit of the butter floats on the water. And he looks at the family and says, "This is the way life is. There are laws. There are dharma. Certain ways that things function. Everything is a result of causes and consequences for action. I can't intercede for you, for your dead relative. He is guided by his past deeds. His spirit, his soul, his consciousness will go according to the law." This is not to say that we should not pray, because our prayers, our intentions, our emotions, our love do have a benefit. They do have a purpose. They do help. But ultimately, what determines our course through life and our course through death is our own action, is the contents of our mind. And in this analogy, this story that's told in Buddhism, the jar is us. That jar contains what we are. The jar is our mind. And what we put into that jar is what we create psychologically in ourselves from day to day, from moment to moment. Because whether we realize it or not, in every moment, the way we pay attention, the way we interact with everything inside and outside of us is creative. Our whole way of existing is a function of creativity. As impressions from life enter into us, with our own hands, psychologically speaking, we take those impressions and transform them according to our own understanding. And the result of that transformation is within us. So in some cases, we may have heard a statement about us, somebody talking about us. We receive those words with our senses, but our mind transforms, translates that information, and ascribes meaning to it. And of course, if we have pride, and we hear someone talking about us in a bad way, in a critical way, it hurts. But that pain is in us, and that pain is a result of our own transformation of that impression. That results in a karmic result, a karmic consequence, which would be, of course, a stone, a rock, that sits inside of our own psychological jar. This is the root of suffering. The root of suffering in all existence is by the nature of our own creation. Because of how we individually, from instant to instant, receive and transform the impressions of life. So the responsibility for our happiness or our pain lies with ourselves. It's not outside. And really, any religion or mystical tradition that you study, you'll discover the same thing is taught. We become what our mind makes us into. And our life, our circumstances outside, are merely a reflection of our own psychology. Our life is what it is because of who we are inside. From this point of view, you can understand why religions and mystical traditions have taught that self-change is the beginning of change. The real esoteric psychology of any religion is to change one's own mind. And in that way, you change your external world, your external circumstances. Of course, this is very difficult to do. But the point of it, the basis of it, rather, is inside of ourselves. We have the capacity to change. And what gives us that capacity is the consciousness. Our own consciousness is that energy that gives us life. It gives us the ability to perceive, to see, to hear, to taste, to touch, to experience. But the consciousness itself is not in the physical body. It doesn't come from the physical body. It comes from far beyond the physical body. It's independent of physical matter. And this is how you can understand dreaming, or out-of-body experiences, or after-death experiences, and many other types of phenomena that modern scientists know nothing about. And this is because they have scarcely begun to understand what the consciousness is and how it works. But of course, in esoteric studies of any religion, the study of the consciousness is the very root, the very spine of those studies. In Gnosis, we call our own consciousness the essence. And when you see a baby, a newborn, and you see their beauty, you see how they radiate happiness and beauty. That is the essence, the consciousness that you can see there. And you can feel it. It's something that you can sense when that free consciousness is there and there's no ego. And you can see it in highly realized masters, that what's there is pure consciousness, pure love, pure peace. For us, though, when we grow up, when we reach 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old, little by little, our own karma is arriving into our psyche and beginning to stifle the consciousness. And little by little, that karma, our own ego, fully incorporates into our own psyche. And then we become a different person. Jealous, angry, fearful, anxious, afraid. So you see here we have competing elements in our mind. We have our essence, our consciousness. We also have ego. So in the story that the Buddha gave, the butter, the ghee, would be symbolic of the consciousness. Would be symbolic of the purity that we have within. That purity naturally belongs to very elevated regions of existence because it's pure. The ego is very heavy, and so it naturally sinks. It belongs to very low levels of life. By ego, we refer to a huge collection of elements, psychological elements that we have inside. Pride, anger, lustfulness, fear, gluttony, envy, jealousy. All of these things are egotistical. They are I's, in other words, the letter I. Because each one of them has its own desire, its own selfish intentions, its own selfish goals. And each one of them arises in our mind according to circumstances. This is why we see such a diversity of intentions and wills and feelings and impulses within ourselves from scenario to scenario, from event to event, from day to day. We see things that come up in us one day and pass away the next. Or that for a few days we feel very strongly about something and then that feeling goes away. This inconsistency is the hallmark of the doctrine of the many eyes. The ego. All of these different egos come into our mind and our heart and our body in order to feed themselves with our creative energy. To take advantage of the energies that naturally flow through us in order to feed themselves and to make themselves fat. And this is how the ego survives from existence to existence. Always whispering in our mind what it wants and trying to manipulate us to fulfill those wants. The diversity of desires in the ego is really astonishing. Many times those desires appear to be beneficial, appear to be useful, but in their base can be very egotistical. From the ultimate point of view, from the point of view of the Dharma, the Gnostic Dharma, the ego itself, in its entirety, has to be removed. And this is why the teachings always emphasize that we need to conquer desire. In those Four Noble Truths, this is what the Buddha was teaching. The cause of suffering is desire. That's the single cause, suffering. Caused by desire. And that desire is in us, not in other people. It's in our own mind, in our own heart. And it's very subtle. We're always being manipulated by one desire or another. So the challenge then is to become aware of that. To learn how to keep an eye on the eye. To always be watching our own mind. To understand our own mind. So that with that knowledge, we can change it. This is the methodology in general, in synthesis. The essential point. To learn about ourselves so that we can change the course of our life. We have this mistaken notion that we can change our external circumstances and acquire happiness. For example, we believe that if we acquire the respect of other people, the admiration of other people, that we'll become happy. But this is essentially untrue. In one moment, people are happy with us, and in the next, they're not. People are fickle. and our opinions and our points of view change like the wind. So we can't rely upon the opinions of others. They will always change. Some of us believe that we can acquire happiness through acquiring material things. And that might be a car. It might be money. It might be a house. It might be a job. It might be an award. It might be a degree. It might be some kind of status. But it's something outside that we want in order to acquire happiness. But unfortunately, the same phenomena applies here. All these external circumstances are impermanent and unreliable. We may acquire one of these new things and discover that it's unreliable. It will decay and fall apart. It may break. It may become worthless. Or it may bring so many other problems into our lives that we suffer even more. So again, with material things, it's unreliable. It's impermanent. We can't rely on it. We can't trust it. The real success that we can find is to learn to find happiness in ourselves. To find our own happiness because of who we are. Because of what we are as a consciousness. To not be dependent on external things. In relationship to this, there's a great teacher from India many centuries ago who wrote a wonderful scripture called Precious Garland. His name is Nagarjuna. And he wrote this: scratching an itch brings pleasure. But more pleasurable than that is not having an itch. Likewise, satisfying worldly desires is pleasurable, but more pleasurable than that is not having desire. This is the basis of real gnosis. To understand that when we can free our own dependency, our own attachment to these desires, to acquiring circumstances or praise, or to acquiring something outside of us, when instead, our mind can be serene and happy and content in and of itself, then we find true happiness. And in that context, we can be happy in any circumstances. No matter what's happening outside of us, whether it's good or bad or indifferent, we can still find happiness inside. So the purpose then, or the method of the Gnostic Dharma, is to help us train our mind. To teach our mind. And this is not acquired or accomplished through imitation. We can't learn this by imitating other people. Our own psyche, our own karma, is ours. And we can only learn to balance our mind, to have balance psychologically, by learning about our own mind. The karma of some other person is different. Their mind is different. Their egos are different. Their psychological idiosyncrasy is different. So by imitation, we can only imitate like a monkey. We can't really learn and know something. So this comes not by imitation, but by revelation. By the revelation of our own consciousness. When our consciousness becomes revealed to us, its use, its function, and that can only arise through practical effort, our own effort. We can begin that now. In this instant, just pay attention. Just learn to pay attention. To consciously direct your attention. To not let your mind take you off into worrying about something or planning something for later or dreaming about a desire that you have or recalling a regret or a memory. But to be here and now. This form of concentrated, directed attention has two important aspects. The first we call self-remembering. The state of self-remembering is a state of consciousness. It begins by us remembering that we're in our physical bodies, by being aware of it, constantly. Not just remembering that every once in a while, but actually being aware that we're in this body. That creates a chemical change in our body. It creates an enormous difference in our feeling of life. We begin to actually experience life as it is when we become aware of ourselves physically. This is very difficult to maintain because the mind is still there pulling on the leash, pulling on our chain, trying to get us to go and be distracted, to think about something else, to be somewhere else. But the very basis, the very foundation of awakening consciousness, of overcoming suffering, is to be here, to be in life. It's very sad when we reflect on recent days, recent weeks, and we can't remember what happened. There are big gaps in our memory. That's very significant. And what it reveals is, in those times that we don't remember what happened, it's because we were not there. Our body was there, but our mind was somewhere else. Our consciousness was somewhere else. This is a grave problem. A very serious problem. And here's why. When we go to sleep at night, our physical body goes and rests. And our consciousness continues to function in the same way it was functioning during the day. If during the day we're always daydreaming and fantasizing and following the urges of our mind to go here and there, we'll do the same at night. This is why our dreams tend to be sporadic, chaotic, and most of the time a repetition of daily life. We go to work, we go home, we cook, we clean, we have problems with our boss, we have problems with our relatives, problems with our spouse. We're repeating, recycling all the same material. All the things we were thinking about during the day, we think about during the night. The mind continues on its stale track. The reason this is a real problem for us is because there's very subtle, slight difference between sleep at night and death. There's only one change. And the only change is that the consciousness is separated from the physical body permanently when we die. But the process of falling asleep and the process of dying are identical otherwise. This is why in the Greek mysteries, the ancient Greek teachings, they symbolized sleep and death as being twins, twin brothers. Thanatos and Hypnos. Twin brothers, they look exactly the same. Sleep and death. And this is not just a myth that some fancy story somebody made up that everybody's supposed to believe in. It's a psychological teaching. It's a spiritual teaching. It contains a truth. And that truth is simply, sleep and death are twins with a very slight difference between them. And that difference is the severance that occurs between the physical body and the consciousness. So if you want to know what will happen to you when you die, all you have to do is look at what happens to you when you go to sleep. You will experience the same thing. If now, in this point in your life, you don't remember your dreams, or the ones you do remember are very vague and obscure, and you have a very difficult time recalling them, you'll have the same experience when you die. You might die today. There's no guarantee. There's no insurance. There's no belief that you can take on that will guarantee you a long life. Every one of us will die. We just don't know when. So we need to look seriously at ourselves and say, am I ready? Am I really ready to face death? Consciously. We may believe that with death, we will then become conscious and be able to choose our next birth, choose where we will go, what we will experience. We may believe we will go to heaven. But as the Buddha taught very clearly in the example of the vase, it is not a question of belief, it's a question of laws. What laws will guide our consciousness? We may have thousands of people who love us and pray for us, but our ego cannot go to heaven. Our ego cannot float on the water and rise up into blissful places. The ego will sink because that's where it belongs, in the depths. But unfortunately, our consciousness is trapped in the ego. We created our ego. When we look at lustful images and pictures, we're taking those images, investing our own energy into it. And that image, that lustfulness, becomes something in our mind. And that is especially powerful, because the sexual energy is the most powerful energy we have. Those transformations that occur in our psyche produce a karma. And that karma is called lust. And so the more we indulge in that type of imagery, which is everywhere now, the more we create that psychological burden in ourselves, which just produces suffering. The only result for that is suffering. As much as you feed any desire, it will never be satisfied. This is written in the laws of Manu, which is the oldest written document in humanity. It says exactly that. The more you feed a desire, the stronger it becomes. So it's important for us to become sincere, to look carefully at ourselves, to study Lojong, mind training. Lojong is Tibetan. But really, a better way to translate this word would be attitude training. The mind is very stubborn and subtle and sneaky. But if we can develop the capacity to develop an attitude that assists us, that gives us the ability to transform our mind, we can change our lives. What's really important here is for us to be sincere. When we talk about the ego, especially when we're just entering into these kinds of studies, it can be difficult for us to see the ego in ourselves, to really understand what that means. And this is because most of us have cultivated and developed a self-image, an idea about who we are as a person. But we have to step back from that a little bit and realize that we made that image for our own convenience. In other words, our own ego made our own self-image. And so our own self-image is there to protect our ego. Oftentimes, those qualities that we say are our greatest virtues can be our worst mistakes. Many of us believe we're very humble, and we're proud of it. This is not humility. This is pride. Some of us believe that we're very spiritual, very religious, but we hoard material things and crave money and comfort. To be sincere about ourselves means to look honestly, to not evade the truth of who we are as people. And this takes a great deal of courage and strength. But if you have your intention set on the greatest good, especially for those who you love, those who you care for, you'll begin to see that you yourself create suffering for those you love. And when you see that and feel that and realize that, then you can develop a strong motivation to change for the benefit of those you love, to help them, to protect them from your own ego. There's a story, and also from Buddhism, that illustrates this concept that we have about our own self-image. Once there was a housewife who had a reputation for gentleness and modesty and courtesy. She was well known in the village as being a very mild-mannered person, very sweet. And she had a housemaid. The housemaid was named Kali, and she was very efficient and industrious and did her work very well. One day, the housemaid thought to herself, "My mistress has a very good reputation for being kind and sweet, very mild. But I wonder if it's true. I wonder if she's really like that, or if everybody just thinks that she's like that. Maybe I'll test her." So the housemaid, the next day, woke up late, didn't prepare anything to eat, didn't get the things ready to begin the activities of the house. So, of course, the housewife became angry and yelled at her and corrected her behavior and said, "You shouldn't be doing this." She got very angry and stormed away. So then the housemaid thought, "It's true. She really does have some anger. She really does have a different quality than what her reputation says. But maybe it's just something inside that she hides well. So maybe I'll test her a little more." So the next day, she woke up even later, slept in. So the house was really getting out of control now. So, of course, the housewife yelled at her even more, cursed her, became very angry, stormed away. So now the housemaid's thinking, "Oh yeah, she's really an angry person. She doesn't deserve her reputation. But I wonder if she will actually show that anger. I wonder if she'll really show it outward instead of just yelling." So the next day she did it again. She slept even later, didn't get up. So the housewife, of course, by this point, was pushed past her limit and came in, yells at the housemaid, and hit her. Took a door bolt, the latch for the door, and hit her on the head. So the housemaid starts to bleed and cowers. She ran out of the house. And all the neighbors came and saw the housemaid bleeding. And the housemaid says, "Do you see this woman who everyone believes is so mild and so courteous and so sweet? She did this to me." So, of course, this destroyed the woman's reputation. This story illustrates something about all of us. We can appear to be one way with the circumstances that support it. But as soon as our circumstances change, entirely new qualities come out. Entirely new faces appear in us. This is a very deep thing for us to grasp about ourselves. Our self-image has been crafted by our own mind in order to make us believe that we're a good person and to give us the idea that everybody else sees us the same way. Nobody sees us the way we see ourselves. Nobody. The thing that we need to learn is to see ourselves truthfully. In the Christian Bible, in the Gospels, Jesus repeatedly corrects the Pharisees, who were the high priests, and he corrects them repeatedly, saying that they clean the outside of the cup, but leave the inside filthy. And what he was describing is what we do with ourselves. We make sure that our exterior appearance looks very clean, looks very nice, but while inside of us, it's filthy, disgusting, and we don't even want to see it. We don't even want to look. We keep that part of ourselves closed because it's painful. It's embarrassing. And this is why many people don't really study Dharma. They don't really study Gnosis. They just want a belief that makes them feel better. They want to have people pray for them or to say prayers for others, but they don't really want to see the truth of their own mind. It's very difficult to find any person in the world who can become their own critic. This is very difficult to find, but it's the doorway to realization. It's the doorway to freedom from suffering, to become our own critic. So the method of the Gnostic Dharma is a science to help us purify our mind of the ego, to take the rocks out of the jar, and to do that every day. In this way, every day, we prepare for death. We awaken our own consciousness, and we free it from pride, from fear, from anger, and we become happy. Little by little, sincerely, truly happy. There's a kind of happiness that's not based in circumstances, but based in conscious awakening. The name Buddha actually means one who is awake. We are not awake. We are asleep. In the same way that our physical body sleeps at night and our consciousness wanders around in our own psychological country, even when our physical body is awake, our consciousness is wandering around in our own psychological country, from thought to thought, from desire to desire, daydreaming, never here. And this is a state of sleep, the sleep of the consciousness. The Buddha is said to be awake. He did not dream. Think about that. Someone who's awake never dreams. They are awake, conscious, aware, with the kind of consciousness that's penetrating, that's perceptive, that's happy. No dreaming. They're very much alive. For us to arrive at that place, we need to remove what obscures our vision and what perpetuates our dream world. As we are now, we're merely being handed back and forth between those two twin brothers from the Greek mythology, Thanatos and Hypnos, sleep and death. And unfortunately, we sleep our whole life away, never present, never in our body, never really living, and then we die. And we pass through the same experience in death, asleep, no awareness, no consciousness, driven by karma. And then we were born again, asleep. And we pass from circumstance to circumstance, always chasing different desires. And then we die again. And we repeat this cycle again and again. The way to change it is to take the rocks out of the vase, to train our mind, to become aware of ourselves, to become conscious of ourselves. There are many things that come out of this. In the first place, we start to live our lives, to actually be conscious of life. This simple thing can totally change your life, because then you begin to make decisions consciously, to make decisions with full awareness of what you're deciding to do, to perform actions with full consciousness, full awareness, full attention. This alone can change your life. At the same time, you start to receive the impressions of life with gladness, with happiness, even if they're difficult. This, in turn, creates serenity and happiness. We also begin to become more aware of the process of sleep. We learn what dream yoga means. Dream yoga is one of the four yogas of Naropa in Tibetan Buddhism. The same science has been taught among the Sufis, among the Aztecs, among the Egyptians. And this is a process whereby we learn to be awake while the physical body sleeps. In other words, we stop dreaming. The physical body sleeps, but our consciousness gets out of the body and goes consciously into the dream world, awake. And in that way, we don't lose all that time that our physical body's asleep. We can utilize it to improve our life and to improve the lives of others. This is called dream yoga. That practice prepares you for death. Because the same conscious separation that you learn to develop with dream yoga, where you consciously separate from your physical body and enter into the astral world, is what happens when you die. Then you would be conscious passing through the process of death, aware of yourself, controlling your mind, conscious. And in this way, you can consciously be involved with the process after death, the process of taking a new birth. Wouldn't this be better? To pass through those experiences with full awareness of it, full consciousness of it, not randomly. This is a moment-to-moment endeavor. Something that we have to do because we want to change. And this process of training our mind, training our new attitude, has three essential parts. The first one is discovery, observation. We have to be aware of ourselves first to learn how to watch our mind in any activity and to look deeply, sincerely at our mind. When thoughts arise, we have to look at, where are those thoughts coming from? Did I call them? Did I want these thoughts? Do I really believe these thoughts? And when feelings come up, we have to separate from those feelings. Question those feelings. Why am I feeling this? Why is this feeling arising in my heart? Do I want this? Is it really beneficial? Is it really good? And the same with impulses in the body. When we're driven to behave in one way or another, we have to control that to become conscious of it. This process of discovery is what I was describing earlier in relation with self-remembering and self-observation. This is where we learn not only to remember that we're here in the body, but to observe it, to consciously watch. And in this way, there's a sort of separation that happens inside of us. The consciousness begins to see that it is not the mind. The consciousness begins to see directly it is not emotion. Our own consciousness can begin to see it is not sensation in the body. It is not the body. It is not the heart. It is not thought. It's beyond those. And when you can taste that and experience that, you have touched an essential jumping off point in your own gnosis. It's that state of active, aware, penetrating consciousness that gives you the ability to start to see the cage of your own mind without obscurity. Right now, as we are, we're trapped in that cage. We can't even see it. We're so accustomed to being in our mind, we're so used to it, that it feels normal. But it is not normal. It's very abnormal. And this is why there's so much suffering in the world. If a prisoner has been in prison a long time, they become attached to their prison. It feels like home to them. Even someone who's being tortured. There are many cases of this. Someone who's been tortured over a long period of time begins to become attached to the torture. It begins to feel that the person who's punishing them loves them and is torturing them as a sign of love. And the person who's suffering that way can begin to become attached to it. This is the sickness of the mind that we have. It becomes so habituated to wrong actions that it wants it. And this is how we can understand the addictions to alcohol, the addictions to drugs, and the addictions to sex. All three of these factors can destroy us. And yet, we love them. But we love them in the wrong way. People love to take drugs, to take alcohol, and to explore and misuse sexuality. But in doing so, they destroy their own minds. They destroy their lives. All of us have that same basis in our own psyche, all of us. That's why we're here. That's why we're suffering. To train our mind means we have to first begin to recognize the cage that we're in. This is discovery, the first part. This process of discovery takes your whole life. It may take more than one life. It might take many existences before you really get to the very bottom of the mind. The point is to start, to do it. Postponing it means you're just deepening your suffering. All of those psychological generators that are in your mind are busy every moment, taking energy from you, building themselves. To change that, to invert that, requires a lot of energy, a lot of effort, but it can be done. Once we begin to discover the mind, to really see the truth of our own egos, we can begin to judge them, to comprehend them. Sometimes we use the word judgment. But we need to understand that word in proper context. Judgment is related to the sphere of Gebra on the tree of life. In Sanskrit, this is called buddhi, which means intellect or intelligence. This is a form of judgment which is conscious. It is not judgmental, the way our own ego is. This is a form of judgment that is a conscious discrimination. We call it comprehension as well. You can call it understanding. A very simple example would be when you're a child and you are first exploring your environment and you have a hot stove. You have no comprehension of that hot stove until you get close to it. And then you feel the heat. And you have a little comprehension there that it's hot, but you may not really comprehend it until you get burned. And then you know to not go near the stove. The same basic function of comprehension needs to occur with our own ego. We may know to some degree that we have lust, or that we have anger, or we have pride or envy. But we need to comprehend how it creates suffering. To really understand in our own mind, in our own experience, how our mistaken views result in problems. When that comprehension begins to arrive, and then we naturally, spontaneously know, I cannot behave that way. I can't let myself think that way. I can't accommodate those behaviors. So it's not simply training the mind to say good and bad. It's to change our attitude, to understand what produces karma, suffering. This is the second phase, which we call comprehension or judgment. This also can take a lifetime or many lifetimes. This is not something that's easy to do. It takes a great deal of effort. We cannot do it just with our physical senses. Our physical senses can only perceive this third dimensional world, this world that's around us now. But your thoughts are not here, physically. You sense them, but not with your physical senses. And the same is true of your feelings. They're not here physically. You can sense them, but not with your physical senses. So to really understand where these feelings and thoughts come from, these desires, where they emerge from, we have to learn how to meditate. Through meditation, we learn how to penetrate consciously into our subconsciousness, to that part of the mind that we don't see with the physical sight, but can only see with conscious sight, And this is the purpose of meditation, to look into our mind. So when we learn during the day to remember ourselves, to observe ourselves, we're actually preparing to do that in meditation, to go into our mind with awareness, with consciousness. We learn to do that in dream yoga, when we step outside of the physical body, to travel in that psychological country and understand our own mind. This is why we need to meditate. When that understanding is complete, when we've really understood the depth of those behaviors, we can proceed to the third stage, and this is execution, death. And this is the point at which we can take that creative energy that previously we were using to create those egos and invert it, and that same energy can be used to destroy them. This is why we see images like Mahakala, great wrathful beings with a lot of fire, and that's symbolic of our own creative energy, which we use to destroy our own ego. When that creative energy, our own energies, are harnessed by will, we can direct those forces against the harmful discursive elements in our own mind and begin to pulverize those rocks, freeing the consciousness, freeing ourselves from pain. That's the essence, the basis, the synthesis of Dharma. The basis, the point, and the function rolled into one thing, which is to train our mind to free ourselves from the ego. A way to think about these three phases, discovery, comprehension, and execution, is to remember what happens to a spy in a time of war. If you're in a time of war and you discover a spy, first thing you have to do is watch them. If you take them out immediately, you won't know who they're working with or how they're doing it. You need to know everything you can about that spy, so you watch them. And of course, the spy is your own ego. Your own ego is a liar and a cheat that always tries to look like your best friend. Your own ego always tries to look like your own virtues, tries to look like God, or Buddha, or an angel. Many people have the experience of seeing what they believe is their own inner Buddha, their own inner being, but it's really their ego. This requires discrimination. When we see that spy, we learn about all their activities. This is the process of discovery. And when we've fully understood and seen everything that that spy does, then we put them on the bench to judge them. This is the process of comprehension. But we cannot judge an ego with an ego. You have to judge the ego with the consciousness, with conscious judgment. And once that judgment is passed, the comprehension is complete, the evidence is presented, and the guilt of the spy is undeniable, then the spy is shot, executed. And this is the essential process that any sincere practitioner of Dharma proceeds with. Along the way, we need to complement this process by cultivating happiness, by learning about the virtues, all the qualities of the consciousness, peace, happiness for others, conscious love, chastity, diligence, tolerance, patience. Sometimes you may encounter students or teachers of Gnosis or Dharma who were very focused on the death of the ego, and this is wonderful, but there's a danger of becoming very morbid, very dark, no sense of humor. And this is unfortunately a mistaken way. The consciousness itself is happiness. It is serenity. It is a form of ecstasy. It is peace. It is love. All of the virtues that any angel or Buddha has are virtues that abide naturally within our own consciousness and that we can fully develop to an infinite degree. So we need to complement our work to place beside the death of the ego the birth of good qualities. And this is why Samaelam Vior wrote in Aztec Christic Magic, to not worry. He says, don't worry. Cultivate the habit of being happy. This is essential. The work on the ego is very difficult. It can be discouraging. It can be embarrassing. It can be extremely painful. We need to balance that. The pain is inevitable. But if we face suffering, difficulties, and pain with a hopeful attitude, with a positive, bright, clear, and active consciousness, then we can easily transcend that pain. But if we're approaching the study of our own mind with morbidity, with depression, with self-hatred, with discouragement, without hope, we will fail. Without question, we will fail. Any questions? Yes. It's a good question. The story of the vase being placed in the lake doesn't really fit in with that concept of a savior who can come and redeem souls. But yet if you think about it, if you really analyze that story, it reveals something very potent. Jesus himself said, no idolater, no adulterer, no murderer, no liar, no thief can enter heaven. He said it flatly and plainly throughout the Gospels. And what he was describing is the rocks. None of those harmful, discursive, egotistical elements that exist within us can go to heaven. So he was stating the same thing that the Buddha was saying. And yet he was saying, I am the way. I am. But that phrase, I am, is very revealing. In this process of any self-discovery, of removing the ego, we cannot do it alone. It's impossible. We need a teacher. We need a guide. We need help. We need assistance. We need a savior. But that savior is not outside of us. It's inside. That savior is within our consciousness, within our own selves. When the process comes for us to discover ourselves, step one, we're helped. We receive a lot of help. Because we have to face our karma. So the help comes through difficulties. Through people that harm us, that try to harm us, that criticize us. This is all a form of help, if we take it the right way. When we have problems in life, it reveals the truth of our mind, and that way we can change. When the process of comprehension is underway, we're meditating and trying to analyze and discover the full root of that ego, we also receive help. This help comes with our practice of meditation, but it comes by help that we receive inside from those who've already done the work, Buddhas, masters, and our own being, the one who's inside of us. And there's also help that comes to us in the process of execution. That very energy that we use to destroy the ego, symbolized in all the traditions by great wrathful beings like Lucifer, Prometheus, the Divine Mother Durga, or Mahakala. Those are all forms of help that come from the gods, come from our own inner God. But there's a stage at which to go further, to go beyond, to really destroy the ego in its entirety, we need another kind of help. In the example, the story of the Buddha and the vase, that help is not illustrated because it's not given to that level of instruction. But that additional help is the form that we see in the bodhisattvas. It's the pure wisdom, the bodhicitta, that they incarnate, that pure light, which is intelligence. In Christianity, it's called Christ. That help is not present in that story, because to receive that help, you first have to be coming out of the water. Yes?
The 10% of consciousness is the butter that floats. The butter, the consciousness that is trapped.
The statement is made that the 3% of consciousness is the butter that floats to the top. Yes, it's true. Yes?
Along the same theme of the current question, you indicated that although the stone cannot flow, nevertheless, our plans and intentions do have some type of effect. Can you say more about that effect?
Sure. Our prayers and good intentions, our well-meaning intentions, have some impact because they are all a form of energy. When we pray for someone else, we're basically sending energy to them, directing energy to them. But that help will directly correspond to the amount of energy that we can send. If we don't have any energy, if we don't have the capacity to manage a lot of energy, then there's not much help we can give. It's helpful, but it may not be enough. As an example, you may know how to put a Band-Aid on a cut. But if someone has cut off their arm, the Band-Aid will be very limited in what it can do. There are different degrees of help that we need to be able to apply. And that's completely relative to the amount of energy that we can control and manipulate consciously. Nonetheless, prayer is good. Prayer is helpful to pray for others. It may be said that the primary reason to do it in the beginning is for us to cultivate a better attitude, to not be so self-obsessed. Little by little, as we develop the ability to manage energy, then we can start to really use that energy effectively to help other people. But in the beginning, without much skill, it's difficult. Yes? When we meditate on the ego, when we meditate on the nature of our mind, the primary thing we look for in the beginning is to comprehend why a certain action is wrong or harmful. But this is only one side of the phenomenon. If we had an argument with someone and we became very irritated and we started to say things that were incorrect or harsh, and later when we reflect on this event, we can see that we didn't say the right things, or we said it with anger, or we said it with too much emotion, or maybe we misjudged. To meditate on the virtue there means that we should meditate to see how should we have behaved. What would have been the right thing to do? So this brings up a good point. We've talked about these three phases, but how do you actually do it? The first thing is, every day, all day, make the effort to be aware of yourself. Make the effort to be in your body, to be present, physically aware of yourself. And in that presence, physically, to consciously direct your attention. When you're paying attention to something, be doing it consciously, not just instinctively or automatically, but doing it by will. Through the course of the day, you will encounter things about yourself that you don't understand, that might be painful, that might be difficult. At the end of the day, you take some time to meditate, to reflect, to review consciously in your imagination those events that passed during the day. You might discover that in the morning, you felt and encountered in yourself a strong surge of pride. And then in the afternoon, you were tempted by a strong surge of lust. And then a little after that, you had a strong situation of anger. So when you get home that night, and you're ready to take your moments to reflect on yourself, then you have to review those events in your mind, to look carefully at them, sincerely, but consciously. Not to theorize, not to justify, nor to condemn, but to analyze objectively, to review it. This is the basic procedure. The more you develop your ability to meditate, the more profound your understanding will become. But anyone can begin this process now. Don't think that you have to wait until you have time to go to a monastery or time to go find a Zen master or a meditation master to teach you this and that. This is a postponement. This is self-evasion. You can start today. You have the ability to use your imagination to relax and to concentrate. What happens is we just need to develop those abilities more. But use what you have. You have your consciousness. You have the teaching. Do it. Every time you make the effort, you develop more skill. What you might find is that your ego then tries to distract you. Exactly. You might find that you have bad habits. Like you want to, when you come home at the end of a hard day, you just want to watch TV. Because you say that's relaxing to you. But if you're really sincere with yourself, you might find that those hours you spend watching TV could have been better spent. There are many ways that we deceive ourselves with habitual behaviors. Some of us spend hours and hours on the internet. And for what purpose? How does it develop our consciousness? This is the kind of questioning we have to apply to ourselves. What is the result of the behaviors that we pursue? What result will come from it? We have to be honest. Our desires do not want us to do this. And our mind will do everything it can to persist in its habits. We become attached to certain things that we like to read, certain things we like to watch, certain things we like to do. Maybe it's shopping. Maybe it's watching movies. Maybe it's reading certain books or magazines. Maybe it's hanging out with friends, gossiping, going here and there. Be honest with yourself. Look back on the past few months or years. What would have been the result if instead of following those behaviors, you would have dedicated some time every day to meditate? By now, you'd have acquired some skill. And so seeing that, then you should begin today. And when those temptations arise to go to this website and that website or to watch this or that movie or TV show, look at yourself honestly. Is this TV show really going to benefit me consciously? Is it really going to help me? What if I die tonight? You might. Any other questions?
Do you think this is a form of mental laziness? You know, it's like society, people seem to go from activity to activity and keep themselves constantly busy. You know, even if it could be good going to museums or wherever it is, but they constantly think by doing things and keeping themselves busy that they somehow are happy. Now, is this
physical busyness always running from here to there and doing this and that is a form of extreme laziness. Extreme. And it's especially prevalent now. Because we have so many things we want to go do. And so many things that we take on that we're responsible for. But definitely it's laziness. It's laziness of the consciousness. It's a way that our ego keeps us distracted so we won't see it. So we'll just keep perpetuating building the ego.
Even though
the things might appear to be beneficial on the surface. Some people are extremely busy with so-called spiritual activities. Going to groups, going to meetings, going to lectures, going to speeches, retreats, events, here and there. And they say, I'm doing all this for the good of humanity. It's all distraction. And you know why? Because their attitude is wrong. There are many examples of this. We need to really analyze our attitude and our impulse. What is the real result from what we do? Even the people like, for example, the seventh Dalai Lama, he said in some of his writings that he felt very badly about himself because he could see that even in performing the rituals and guiding people and writing books and doing all the activities that he was responsible for as a Dalai Lama, in the back of his mind, he still could always see that he wanted his own comfort. And he felt bad. He said, I see in myself that I'm just a materialist. Because I'm doing all these things and ultimately I'm expecting to benefit. Imagine that. A Dalai Lama. And what about us? So even Milarepa, when he spent many years meditating in isolation, said that he would go and look for a new cave to meditate and would be looking for something to comfort him. And he said, still, the poison of worldly desire blows through my mind. Any other questions? Well, good luck. The presentation of this lecture was made possible by donations from listeners like you. Help humanity discover the sacred wisdom that leads to liberation from suffering. Make a donation to Telema Press. Visit GnosticTeachings.org for details. Thank you for your support. May all beings be happy.